Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, editor of the Jerusalem Post, and joined as always by Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and our diplomatic correspondent. And Lahav, I just have one question for you today. Have you given money yet?
To whom?
Oh, come on. Everyone's been donating to Bibi, right? For his legal fees, right? There's the GoFundMe. I saw today they've raised already over 3 million shekel. I mean, I think, you know, the guy is really, what do we call it in Hebrew? Misken, right? He's poor.
He doesn't have any
money. He's a nebuch. He needs our help.
Clearly. He needs our money.
I think he's the richest prime minister who ever served in office in Israel. He was a multimillionaire at the time already.
Yeah. I think Ehud Barak is now richer than he is, but I don't think he was when he was prime minister.
Putting sarcasm aside, the Netanyahu plea deal, which is really the big story of the week here in Israel. The former prime minister has apparently instructed his attorneys to try to take advantage of the last 2 weeks of the Israeli Attorney General Avichai Mandelblit's term in office. He's wrapping up 6 years in the role in just a couple of weeks. And Netanyahu is trying to see if he can knock out a plea bargain deal within these last couple of weeks. And what do you think, Lahav? Is that where he's going? Is he finally going to be stepping off the national stage?
I really don't know. The reports are, and this sounds likely to me, is that his wife and his son Yair don't want him to take the plea deal, while his son Avner does want him to. And the reason that this sounds about right to me is that Yair Netanyahu is on social media all the time, so we can get some sense of his personality. And he seems like someone who always wants to be right, you know, and that he doesn't want to like give the satisfaction to whomever is against his father, that his father will admit to some guilt, even though it's only to the lesser charges.
For the record, by the way, I'm blocked by Yair Netanyahu on Twitter, so I don't have the privilege or the pleasure of being able to read his really poetic tweets.
Yes,
I've heard. They're quite poetic.
Yeah, I'm not blocked, but I can't say that I'm an enthusiastic follower. Let's put it that way. He's a very angry person.
Yeah.
And to some extent, I can understand living under like that magnifying glass is difficult, but he's a very angry person.
Look, I think that Bibi, at the end of the day, right, understands that this trial is moving forward, right? The testimonies are being heard. The state's witnesses are providing what they said they would provide so far. They're delivering. There's a good chance he could go to jail at the end of all of this. And Mandelblit, who's the outgoing attorney general, used to serve as his cabinet secretary, might be his best ticket to get the best deal possible, even though it will include a conviction.
I think it's in his personal best interest to take the plea deal. I mean, I get that there's a matter of principle here and whatever, but, you know, there's a good chance that this could end up with him being guilty and him going to jail. I mean, we already had a prime minister go to jail. So it's just like not worth the risk. Now, what we didn't mention is that the plea deal would mean that he can't, it would include a crime with moral turpitude, which is like the Israeli equivalent of a felony.
You know, I always think of turpentine. Do you also? I always think of turpentine.
Yeah,
but when we talk about the moral turpitude,
what it means in practicality is that he can't run for politics for 7 years, and that's what like his supporters are furious about this because A, the principle of him admitting guilt when he said all the time he's not guilty, and B, that he wouldn't be able to be prime minister anymore. And then many of his opponents are angry about this because they want justice served and they feel like it's not justice if Bibi doesn't go to jail. And what's interesting is that in the pro-plea bargain camp is now Aaron Barak, the former president of the Supreme Court and sort of the father of judicial activism in Israel. So someone who the right really doesn't like. And right. One of his reasons for thinking that Netanyahu should get a plea deal is that he said Netanyahu was one of the great defenders of the judiciary in Israel. Before Netanyahu was potentially on trial, you know, before he was being investigated, it's true, he stopped a lot of right-wing initiatives opposing judicial activism. So it's sort of, but it's ironic because in the last few years, he really railed against the courts.
First of all, I think you're right that, you know, the camp that is against him signing a deal is twofold, right? You have the people on the right who feel that he should fight and keep on fighting because he's their representative and he's the man who is fighting their battle against the so-called alleged left-wing plot by the police and the prosecution to bring down their fearless leader, Netanyahu. And then there's the people on the left who are against the deal. Some people on the left, at least, who feel that the deal is not good enough. It's not good enough that Netanyahu will be distanced from politics and kept away for 7 years. He needs to go to jail, right? It's like they're motivated out of some sense of they need revenge for something. Personally, I'm in favor of the deal. And I'll tell you why, right? One of the things I think if you look at Israel today, in contrast, let's say, to the United States, in the U.S., there are real ideological issues and matters that divide people, right? Abortion, right to bear arms, who won the elections in November 2020, and other matters, for that matter.
Yeah.
In Israel, there's no real ideological issue that divides us, right? I think even the left and the right, they both know. Everyone knows there's not going to be a two-state solution tomorrow, and everyone knows there's not going to be an annexation of all the West Bank tomorrow.
I don't know about that, though. And maybe it's because I know a lot of people who are, like, journalists and, and politicians. But I do think that there is a very big divide over two states or not, or at least the very least people who oppose the quote-unquote occupation or not. Like, maybe that's a better framing.
Yeah, but that's a fringe, it's a fringe within the people who are out there speaking against the occupation on a daily basis is a tiny, tiny number of people.
Right.
Who can probably be counted among Meretz and B'Tselem. But this is not even mainstream labor today is not there. And I think that my point is that if you look at what the fault line is between Israelis over the last few years, and this is what led us, by the way, to four consecutive elections. It wasn't because we couldn't form a government because people were debating about what the right economic policy should be for the state of Israel, what the right welfare policy or what the right peace policy should be. It was about Netanyahu. And only about Netanyahu. And therefore, if he does step off stage, there's a chance for this country to actually heal, I think, in some way. Maybe I'm naive. I don't know. That's always an option.
Like, I agree that I think that the tone will be more civil, let's put it that way, that things will be a lot less heated, that it's become this sort of tribal thing, and it's all about Netanyahu. I do think, like, there are still real disagreements, right? That even before Netanyahu, Netanyahu was always, from the time he sort of really entered politics or from the time he ran for leader of Likud, he was this sort of larger-than-life figure. But, like, if we go back and look, I don't know, from 2009 to 2015, when things seemed, like, a little bit more in proportion, like, people still disagreed over things. But I do think that maybe things will be a little bit more sane. That being said, like, you look at the U.S. and, like, whatever you think about Biden and his, like, specific policy issues or whatever, I thought things would be a lot more quiet and sane in the U.S. after Trump left. And it's still crazy. It's a different crazy. It's not like, what is the president going to tweet every day? But things are still very heightened and very ugly in the politics there.
I think that's 100% true. And that talks to the division and the polarization that you have there. But here it's become about this style of personality politics, which, by the way, I think they have in America, definitely around Trump.
But, right, like, I think, exactly.
But I think that here it might have been taken to an extreme, and I wonder what will happen if we take that out of the equation. Because if we think about it for a moment, the fact that this government, the so-called change coalition, came together and was able to form a government led by Bennett and Lapid, together with Labor, with Meretz, with the Arabs, with the right, Gideon Saar, and Bennett's own party, showed that there is an ability to put aside that 20-30% of ideological issues that people disagree about and focus on the major issues like COVID, the economy, relations with the United States, keeping us safe from the Iran nuclear threat and other issues, and focus on those. So I do wonder what would happen if Netanyahu was taken out, but that also leads us, Lahav, to the big question, which is what happens politically if Netanyahu suddenly steps down? Right. Well, what happens to this government?
Yeah, this week, Yair Lapid said in a faction meeting, a Yesh Atid faction meeting, something along the lines of, I think this government is going to live out its days. I think there's still going to be the rotation, meaning that Lapid will be prime minister in 2023. I trust Naftali Bennett and Ayala Shaked. And I don't think it's a matter of trusting Naftali
Bennett, at least, maybe Shaked. Bennett, you know, if Bibi leaves, Bennett will not want anything to change because Bennett is prime minister and he probably won't be prime minister ever again or in any other sort of formulation of a coalition. But someone like Ayelet Shaked, who is very uncomfortable in this diverse coalition, or someone like Gideon Saar and basically everyone in his party who were Likudniks their whole careers before this, or almost their whole careers, because Elkin was in Kadima for a hot minute, they want to go back to Likud. They want to be back in their base. So the only reason they're out is because they couldn't deal with being with Netanyahu anymore. And I think that there is a chance that his coalition could fall apart once Likud comes up with a new leader. Of course, that's on the condition that Likud itself doesn't fall apart.
Right. Well, let's also remind our listeners exactly how this all works. If Netanyahu steps down and the Likud party does not succeed in appointing a temporary or an interim chairman, and they go to a primaries, which has to be held in, I guess, you know, 60 or 90 days within the party, and they choose, let's say, a new chairman, that chairperson, whether a man or a woman, will be able to then go to people in the current existing Knesset and say, let's form a new government, and then could bring what's called a constructive no confidence motion to the Knesset for a vote, which, if that person has a majority, will be able to pass that into law, bring down the existing government, and right away establish a new coalition. And I think you're right that if you look at who's in the current coalition, right, so Likud, together with the ultra-Orthodox parties and the party known as the Religious Zionist Party, led by Bezalel Smotrich, together with the one defector, Amichai Shikli, from Bennett's party, counts 53, right?
Right.
All they would really need is Benny Gantz to come over. That's another 8, and they get to 61. But also, yeah, Gideon Saar would come. Now, why would Gantz come? Because Gantz doesn't want Lapid to be prime minister. That's his nemesis. The last thing he would want is for Lapid to be prime minister. And Gideon Saar does not want Bennett to continue being prime minister, and also would not want Lapid to be prime minister in 2023. So everyone has this motivation to come over. And then, by the way,
well, I also think, yeah, Gideon Saar, we should remember, is not passing the threshold on any polls. So I think the only way for him to have a political future is to rejoin Likud. And then the question is, will Likud let him rejoin? Right. Because he is as formidable a competitor to be head of Likud as, you know, certainly anyone else, nearby Kat, Yisrael Katz.
No, 100%. But I think that they all will want to come to this new Likud government because, A, they'll feel more at home in a right-wing coalition, and B, is they will take Bennett out of the equation and they'll stop Lapid. And none of these guys really like Lapid to the extent that they would want to stay in a coalition with him to and allow him to become prime minister.
Right. And Gantz, I think, feels, we should mention, because Gantz, it's not that Gantz is so ideologically aligned with the right. I mean, he's not. If there's anyone in this coalition who's pushing for, like, if not a two-state solution, then steps towards negotiations, it's Gantz. Interestingly, and not Meretz, but he's so sort of like embittered because he feels like he should be prime minister now because he had that rotation deal with Netanyahu, and he would have been prime minister by now if Netanyahu had honored that deal. So that really would be that's the reason he's a flight risk.
Flight risk from the current coalition. Interesting.
Yeah.
How do you put the chances of this all happening, Lahav?
I think there's a pretty good chance. In the Knesset, people like to play these like games of Tetris. It's been a long time since there's a coalition that, let's say, lasted more than a couple of years and didn't have some sort of reconfiguration.
So we'll have to wait to see. It'll be interesting in the next couple of weeks whether the deal is reached between Netanyahu's lawyers and Avichai Mandelblit, whether it's before Mandelblit steps down or it's with whoever succeeds him as attorney general or as the state prosecutor. But stay tuned, because Israeli politics will never cease to drive you crazy and excite people. But Lahav, you had a story last week, which I also wanted to just bring to the attention of our listeners, about ties or normalization with Indonesia and how there's been this whole, I don't know how to describe it, like a racket behind the scenes that's been operating to get the Indonesian government to normalize relations with Israel. And they've been doing it through agriculture. There've been people involved in the United States and in Indonesia, here in Israel, in other countries. Why don't you fill us in on what's going on there?
Yeah, well, if we go back to when the Abraham Accords were signed in the last quarter of 2020, Indonesia was a big target, I guess you would say, like one of the countries that Israel most wanted to establish ties with in the Arab and Muslim world. Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country. And, you know, it's interesting, when I was doing research for this story, I found something that I had forgotten about, that in 2016, I had written about Tzipi Chotoveli, who's now our ambassador in London, but at the time was deputy foreign minister. And she said, oh, Israel has contacts with Indonesia all the time, and we would love to turn to make them formal. So this was in 2016 already. But in any case, in 2020, the Trump administration was really pressuring the Indonesians. They made huge offers to double their aid, basically, to their development aid to Indonesia.
Right.
And it didn't happen. I mean, this was already after the election, so when Trump was sort of a lame duck. And now the Biden administration, well, actually, if we back up a bit, in November, there was a conference in Bahrain that National Security Advisor Eyal Hulata participated in. And he met there with the defense minister of Indonesia. And there was actually a photograph of Israel's ambassador to Bahrain with the defense minister of Indonesia. And at the time, the defense minister's office said something along the lines of, you know, we were talking about things for the benefit of Indonesia's national interests, and that there's no problem with that, even though we don't have relations. Okay. Then the next month came along, and there was news that we were able to confirm that Secretary of State Blinken spoke with his counterpart in Indonesia about normalization with Israel. So I managed to find a bunch of different sources who have actually been involved in these Indonesia-Israel relations. One has been involved in agriculture cooperation between Israel and Indonesia. And he talked about that it's very extensive, and that actually this defense minister who was talking to Hulata in November is involved in it, that food security is a very big issue in Indonesia, and that they are using Israeli technologies and collaborating with Israel. And there's an American businessman named Joey Allaham, who's been involved in trying to bring ties between Jews and Arab Muslim nations in the past, and actually had to register as a foreign agent in the U.S. But in this case, he has investments in Indonesia. He's involved in business in Indonesia, and he brought these groups together and used business. He did business with someone who is a former, very, very senior intelligence figure in Israel. I can't say names because this person wouldn't. I got confirmation from multiple people, but this intelligence agent wouldn't confirm it, even though this thing that I'm fairly certain involves him. In any case, very senior intelligence figure in Israel,
okay,
who does business in Indonesia. And through that, these like back channel normalization talks began, like, or restarted, I would call it, in the last year or so. And it involved also COVID cooperation. And, you know, I wrote this story about agriculture last week. So just this week, in the area of health cooperation, an Indonesian delegation came to Israel.
What makes Indonesia so important, or so of such interest to Israel?
So, like I said earlier, it's the most populous Muslim country in the world. So you're getting hundreds of millions of Muslims who now have like an opportunity for better relations with Israel. And it's also just a very big country. So that's a big sort of economic thing for Israelis. You know, I mean, you see how many Israelis have been traveling to Dubai and Abu Dhabi. Just imagine if we could go to Bali easily. That's going to be a huge right. one.
By the way, I've been to Bali.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting place in another life. Well, Lahav, we'll have to wait and see. I've heard from people who were involved in some of these talks, and I wonder what you think, if that the current administration in Washington is just not interested, and they're not pushing these as hard as they were pushed under, not necessarily, I want to say, the Trump administration, by certain players in the Trump administration who made it a priority, and that's what made this stuff happen and these past deals. But because if you don't have serious U.S. involvement, these deals are not going to be made. And there's skepticism if something will actually materialize here.
That's part of the issue, right? For Indonesia, like, the benefits, they're getting them anyway, right? They have sort of minimal trade with Israel. They're having this cooperation in agriculture and in health anyway without relations with Israel. And so, I mean, they should be looking at what's going on with the UAE and how trade has skyrocketed between Israel and the UAE. But mostly it seems that the U.S. has to make it worth their while, and not just them, also other countries, like other African states that have been considering it, you know, because they saw that the U.S. was willing to do that for Sudan and Morocco, for example. So they want to see what they can get out of this deal as well. And so the Biden administration really does have to buy into it. Now, for Blinken to be talking to them about it is a big thing. But probably the U.S. would have to make some other promises, not just talk.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll have to keep an eye also on Indonesia. Lahav, this week we sat down for an interview, a double interview, I would say, at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Center with the Yad Vashem chairman, Dani Dayan, former consul general of Israel to New York, as well as with Israel's Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Nachman Shai. We spoke about what happened in outside of Dallas at the Beth Israel congregation in Texas, where there was that standoff for 11 hours with a UK national who came in armed into the sanctuary and held four people hostage. And of course, next week, looking forward to the International Holocaust Memorial Day. What is the state of the fight against anti-Semitism? What is going on with the commemoration of the Holocaust? An interesting conversation, I would say, with the two of them.
You know, they're both such interesting people that I wish we had more time just to talk about other things. I mean, Dani Dayan used to be the head of the Yesha Council and ran for politics a couple times. And Nachman Shai has been, I mean, he's like a legend for Israelis. Certainly Israelis, in our age groups, because he was the, and this is, I think a lot of our listeners wouldn't know this, because he was the IDF spokesperson during the Gulf War in the early 90s. And he's very famous for being very calming, like a very calming television presence when he was on TV telling people that they need to tape up their windows because there might be gas attacks from Saddam Hussein. And his most famous catchphrase is drink water. He would say on TV to people, drink water to calm down.
Shtumaim.
Exactly. Shtumaim. And I just, he's Diaspora Affairs Minister now, and he used to be the head of the Jewish Federations of North America's office, in Israel. So he does have he was a professor, at Emory recently, a visiting professor. So he has a lot of experience with like U.S. Jews, diaspora Jews for sure. But I think that maybe the diaspora Jews who meet him don't know his history and like how he was this beloved figure in Israel.
But you know what, Lahav, when we met with him, did you notice what he was drinking?
He was drinking a lot of water, yeah.
No, I thought it was coffee. He had a cup of coffee.
No, oh, he was drinking coffee? Oh, would have been a better joke if it was water. Well, yeah. Oh, well.
Here's the interview we did this week with Dani Dayan, chairman of Yad Vashem, and Israel's Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Nachman Shai. Here we go. Next Thursday, on January 27th, the world will mark the International Day for the Commemoration of the Holocaust. And we've gathered at Yad Vashem, the World Holocaust Remembrance Center, with its chairman, Dani Dayan, a former Consul General of Israel to New York, as well as with Israel's Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Dr. Nachman Shai, to discuss recent events in Texas, but also how the world and how Israel can fight anti-Semitism and also commemorate the Holocaust. So, Nachman, we'd like to start with you. What is the lesson that we're supposed to take away from this? We saw what happened in Texas. We're on the eve of a day that the world is supposed to commemorate the Holocaust. We saw you, as well as other Israeli leaders, stand in solidarity with what was happening to the Jews in Texas. What's the big takeaway?
First of all, I take something that maybe you didn't notice, that there are attempts to claim that it was not anti-Semitic action or act, but it was just another terror attack. It's like taking it from certain context, which is maybe more comfortable to some people, that will blame terror as a general phenomenon. No. I mean, if it was not about Jews, why didn't walk into a Jewish, to a synagogue? Probably there was a mosque or church. Why not the supermarket across the street? He was looking for Jews. And this is something very typical, that many people and many states and many organizations try to ignore the very fact that anti-Semitism is still around and kicking very high.
Why do you think it's so hard for the authorities in a lot of different places? I mean, in the past, President Barack Obama talked about people in a deli, about the shooting in the supermarket in Paris, and French authorities have also been reluctant to identify certain attacks on Jews as anti-Semitic. So why do you think that is?
It's quite of a denial. They try to deny the very fact that anti-Semitism is still here. Back, especially Europe, which has suffered so much from anti-Semitism. And only those who have, let's say, open eyes can look at it and say, yes, we understand. And we look at the statistics. We look at the figures. We know it's coming up. We know it's growing. It's been growing. And I can give you some examples. And also, it's much, as I said before, it's much easier to say, well, this is something else. It's not exactly against Jews. That's against foreigners, xenophobia. This is just against another terror attack. No. Jews, in this case and another, is in the center. But it's terror. There are terror attacks as well. But this was anti-Semitism.
Right. Danny, we're sitting in your office in Yad Vashem. I'm looking at you sitting on a couch next to Minister Shai with four portraits of four Holocaust survivors, two females, two men, very powerful images. So I'm curious, first of all, as you reflect on the incident in Texas and the commemoration that's coming up, but also more specifically back in 2018 when you were serving as Consul General of the State of Israel in New York, was the event at the attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, and you went there and stood in solidarity with the Jewish community on behalf of the State of Israel. So this is not a new phenomenon, right? This is something that sadly Jews in America have been through. State of Israel has stood with them. How do you put it all together?
You know, I must admit that I was naive when I took my position as Consul General of Israel to New York, which is in some senses, among other things, the ambassador of Israel to the Jewish community in the United States at large. I believe that anti-Semitism will not be high on my agenda. If to be even more sincere, I thought at that stage that anti-Semitism is sometimes used by Jewish organizations to raise funds. But then reality slapped on my face. It started gradually. It started, I remember going to a cemetery in a suburb of Philadelphia, in a Jewish cemetery that was desecrated, and then with the mayor of Rochester, New York, to visit a desecrated Jewish cemetery there, and a swastika in Sutton Place Synagogue in Manhattan. And then came Charlottesville. Charlottesville was the first watershed moment. Nazi flags being waved in the streets of a big city in the United States was shocking. By the way, in most countries, European countries, not only in Israel, that will be not only morally repugnant, but also criminally punishable. Not in America. And the second, of course, as you mentioned, was Pittsburgh. I arrived to Pittsburgh, which was Pennsylvania was part of my jurisdiction. I arrived to Pittsburgh when the bodies were still lying on the ground, on the floor in the Etz Chaim Tree of Life Synagogue. And I stayed for an entire week there. That nothing was the same after Pittsburgh. But unfortunately, we are not only talking about Pittsburgh. Then came Poway, California, and the kosher grocery in Jersey City, New Jersey, and the stabbing in the Hanukkah celebration in Muncie, New York. 15 Jewish fatalities, 15 Jewish murdered in anti-Semitic incidents. I remember a few weeks before Pittsburgh, I was in a commemoration to Mirel Knoll, the Jewish woman that was murdered in Paris. And I noticed that in France, a shocking figure, in France, 11 Jews were murdered in 10 years. But then in the United States, 15 Jews is in less than 2 years. That means that we have a tremendously grave problem, not only in Europe, but also in America.
Do you think from your experience, and you know, Donnie and then Nachman, I'd like to get your input on this too. Do you think the U.S. authorities are doing enough? Because, I mean, unfortunately, we're seeing this trend. I mean, you just outlined the list of attack after attack after attack.
It's difficult to say what is enough, but I will tell you something about us, not about the Americans. And I know that Minister Shai is...
It's a nice way not to answer.
No.
Danny was a diplomat.
Danny is still a diplomat.
He's still a diplomat. I know that Minister Shai is very aware of what I am saying and does it very well. Israel doesn't have authority to act in foreign soil. But the fact that we don't have authority doesn't mean that we don't have responsibility. We have responsibility even when we lack authority. An anti-Semitic incident, even if it happens thousands of miles from the shores of Tel Aviv or from the hills of Jerusalem, is a domestic issue for us. And that means that the Israeli government and Israeli diplomats should express themselves very clearly. I did it with local, state, and federal authorities, demanding them to do more. The results show that not enough is being done.
So one of the things that Israel has been pushing for is for more and more countries and more institutions to adopt the IHRA working definition of anti-Semitism. Do you think that's helping? Do you think that's something important that we need to continue doing?
Of course, IHRA is an international organization by itself, and it encourages states and organizations and NGOs to join in and to partner with IHRA. I've been to Austria recently, a few weeks ago, for their memorial, Remembrance Day for the Holocaust, and Austria has a lot to remember. And by the way, it does. It's unbelievable how they now recognize, looking backward, to their responsibility for the Holocaust. They used to say they are the first victims. Now they understand they are not. They were not. Maybe at the time it looked like that, but no longer. And at that time there were a meeting of around 50 soccer clubs from all over Europe, led by Chelsea, to join in and regarding fans in soccer stadiums all around Europe. They used to use anti-Semitic language and so on. So I think this is something that has to continue and to encourage more states, more organizations, and individuals to feel like anti-Semitism is not over. There is a new definition. There's a new way to approach anti-Semitism in 2022. And we are, as I said, I just want to follow the previous questions. We have a responsibility. I agree with Danny. And we have to do much more. The state of Israel has to do much more. Danny was just nice. He knows what I mean. Even as a consul general at the time, we have to take a proactive role in combating anti-Semitism.
So what does that mean? What does Israel need to be doing?
First of all, we are now monitoring the social media networks, and we pick up information and we collect it and we publish it. And a week from today, we'll submit it to the government. Danny will be there too. And for half an hour, the government of Israel will discuss it. That's not enough. We have to figure out what can we do about the social media. Social media became a nest for anti-Semitism. It's coming in huge number. Only last year, 3.5 messages on those networks. I'm not sure we picked up all of them. 420,000 users. It says something. It's an open market. Everyone can say what he or she wants. Okay, so they abused the system. We have to figure out what can we do about it. Not by ourselves. We should turn to the social media technological, those giant technological companies, and charge them for that and say, what are you going to do about that? If they don't do, maybe we can do other things. So I can give you more and more. I mean, anti-Semitism did not disappear. It just has new forms. And we have to struggle with the new forms of anti-Semitism.
New forms and old forms. New forms.
In addition to the old ones. And Israel should look at it, I mean, in open eyes and say, well, we are here. This is the Jewish state. We are the Jewish state, the only one in the world. Right. And we have a commitment, and we are in Yad Vashem, where this commitment is so powerful and speaks for itself.
Danny, so International Holocaust Day to commemorate the victims, January 27th. I think, you know, and Minister Shai just mentioned the technological companies, and, you know, Facebook, I think it was just a couple of years ago, said that it would no longer allow Holocaust denial on its platform, but anti-Semitism talk is still allowed.
Right. So, and what's anti-Semitism?
Right. And right, so you see that, you know, maybe Holocaust, and we were chatting just before, where do we stand in terms of Holocaust denial, right? In the world, online, offline, what's the state of affairs?
You know, the relatively good news is that Holocaust denial, outright Holocaust denial, is now relegated mainly to the lunatic fringes of the social media. And no respectable world leader, journalist, intellectual, influencer would stand today on a stage and say that the gas chambers did not exist. Probably in Iran they will, probably in other very even limited parts of the Muslim world they will, but not in other places. We will not hear outright denial that 6 million Jews were murdered. We are very troubled today is by two other phenomena. The first one is Holocaust distortion, and the second is Holocaust trivialization. Holocaust distortion is the most common manifestation of Holocaust distortion these days. It's made by governments. By governments or by strong social or political forces in countries, mainly in Eastern Europe, but not limited to Eastern Europe. And the narrative is this. Of course there were gas chambers. Of course 6 million Jews were murdered by the Nazis. But each one says, in each country people say, but in my country, all of my compatriots were righteous among the nations. There were no collaborators with the Nazis. We were victims of the Nazis. Not true. In every single European country, maybe, you know, Albania is an exception. In every European country under Nazi occupation or influence, there were collaborators that murdered Jews, period. And the attempt to deny that by government, in some cases even to criminalize
Like Poland as an example.
That is one example, but not the only one. We just saw legislation in Belarus that talks about the Belarusian Holocaust, not differentiating, not acknowledging that there was a big difference between the treatment of the Belarusians that suffered a lot, no doubt, and the Jews that were persecuted and murdered to the last one.
And I mean, there are other places where it's like less obvious, right? Where countries that'll have Holocaust museums that will, or museums of what happened in World War II that will sort of relegate the Jews to similar standing as Hungarians or other people.
Yeah. Even we saw here in Yad Vashem, leaders of the world, and I'm definitely not talking about Angela Merkel, on the contrary, that came here and spoke about the Holocaust without mentioning their collaborationist groups or even governments. So that's a serious problem. And the second is obviously the trivialization that goes rampant now with the COVID-19. Equating mandates of masks or vaccines to the yellow star, which is obviously abhorrent. Yeah.
I saw one Holocaust survivor woman tweet that to someone who had made that comment that, trust me, as someone who stood in line, who went through the Selexia with Mengele, this has nothing to do with one another.
But if I add one more sentence, I think the worst... I don't know, it's denial, a distortion or trivialization of all of them is, of course, the abhorrent comparisons being made in some places between the Israel and Nazi Germany.
Sure.
And Jews.
Since we are in Yad Vashem and we're talking on the eve of the Holocaust Commemoration Day, the international, I'm curious, you know, the Holocaust played a huge role in the Jewish identity of many diaspora Jews from around the world, especially, you know, definitely my parents' generation, second generation, two Holocaust survivors, people like that, that the Holocaust is what pushed a lot of Jews, for example, from countries around the world to move to Israel, and forge that Jewish identity. But as we see the Holocaust moving farther away in time, survivors passing from this world, it's not playing as that same role. So I'm curious to the both of you, maybe we'll start with you, Nachman. We have to come up with new ways to engage with people. It's not enough to say the state of Israel will save you from a Holocaust, right? So, I mean, that falls into your responsibility.
We repeat on this famous saying, that we remember the past, but we have to look at the future. And yes, the Holocaust in general shaped the first 4 years of the state of Israel in many ways. Many Israelis citizens came from Poland or Russia or Eastern Europe, like my parents, and also the spirit of never again and so on. But now we are independent, sovereign state, strong, successful, a high-tech, leading high-tech country and so on. So we've achieved so much. Now we have to ask ourselves how to define the character of Israel. So that's a Jewish democratic state, moral state, carrying the spirit of the thousands of years of history, and contributing to the world, asking ourselves what is our role as Jews and a state in the world today. And that's we have a mission in this world. I truly believe we have a mission in this world. Let's ask ourselves what is the mission and how to implement it. There's much more to do. We should bear the memories and always remember what happened to our nation. But we cannot live daily just on those memories. And always when someone says something against Israel somewhere around the world, blame him or her of anti-Semite and bring the Shoah again. Shoah has a place in Jewish history, always with us, but we have to look at the life of the Jewish people today, not only out of the death of 6 million of them.
Danny?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, when I receive here dignitaries from the world, I used to tell them that there are many lessons from the Holocaust. Some are individual, some are national, some are universal, and sometimes I even admit that the lessons can be contradictory. But we in Yad Vashem, as an Israeli, Jewish, and openly Zionist organization, I choose to present two of our lessons to the visiting dignitaries. The first one, as Minister Shai said, is the importance, the vital importance of a Jewish, independent, secure, robust state in our homeland. You know, we all were figuratively in the St. Louis, going from dock to dock and from port to port, being refused entry in North America, Caribbeans, and Latin America. As long as Israel exists, and Israel, I hope, will exist forever.
Just for some of our listeners who might not know the history, the St. Louis was a ship and that was trying to flee Europe, and no one was willing to accept them.
It was ultimately sent back to Europe.
And was sent back to Europe, and the Jews were eventually killed. If Israel exists, there will always be a safe haven for the St. Louis. And the second thing is that we are not in Europe of the 30s, okay? The world in 2022 is not Germany of the 30s. But there is a huge difference between us and our contemporary generation and the generations of those days. And that is that we have the experience they lacked. We today know that anti-Semitism can grow to monstrous dimensions. And probably they didn't imagine that it's possible. We know that it happened once, can happen again. And therefore, I tell them, when you see anti-Semitism, confront him immediately, forcibly, and decisively. That doesn't mean, as Minister Shai aptly said, that everything is anti-Semitism. No, we have to be very careful when we define, when we characterize something as anti-Semitic.
So we're sitting here at Yad Vashem, and it's pretty quiet here, which is unusual. But in COVID times, there's far fewer visitors. And I wanted to know if Yad Vashem is making any sort of efforts online or having new educational initiatives to make up for the fact that the bulk of the visitors to Yad Vashem who live outside the country can't be here.
Sure. The museum used, first of all, you know, I refer now to your introduction, Yaakov. Yad Vashem is not a museum. Yad Vashem is a center, an institution that has also a museum as part of it.
I stand corrected.
we used to have more than 1 million visitors per year, 70% of them are out of the country, foreign tourists. Now we have less than around 100,000, most of them Israelis. I hope soon we will be back again in full capacity. But yes, then we enhanced our online capacities. Our website has extensive material, lessons, courses online, and our research and documentation continues unaffected by COVID, almost unaffected by COVID, which is also a very important part of our activity.
And a similar question for Minister Shai. I mean, there's been such a disruption in Jewish people being able to visit. Birthright has been reduced to a fraction of its usual visits. How do you think that the Israel diaspora relationship will fare, you know, after 2 years of COVID and who knows how much longer?
Well, it's a good question because Israel is the center of life of many Jews. Actually, we made everything possible that they relate to Israel as the center of life. Even if they don't live physically in the country, they relate to Israel as the center. They come and visit, they invest, they send their kids, they have grandchildren here. I met many of them. They invest their money here. They buy, purchase the apartments. They said, okay, this is our second state. But sometimes they feel like this is the first one. And I'm very upset about what happened. And I've heard it from many, many friends of mine that said, we would like to come. We would like to return to the places we like. We feel like we miss something significant in our life. So we've done everything to reopen the borders and Lod Airport and to let people come in. Now it's a time where they can, but I'm not sure they would like to come in this COVID-19 area. But we have to work very hard to make it possible for them to visit and to come to stay here as long as possible. And also at the same time to figure out, we live in a new era now. Maybe COVID-19 will stay around for more than a few months, few weeks or few months. And we have to figure out what can we do virtually, what can we do remotely. And I'm working on that. We have devoted 40 million shekels from our budget now to think how to help Jewish education in this era, new era, how to teach teachers and principals to work in a time like that, and that Israel will remain the center of this of those educational institutes. So maybe not that. I mean, maybe Yad Vashem and maybe Mount Herzl and some other sites in Israel, so we can share the experience with them. They can come and visit from the distance, remotely visit Yad Vashem. I would like them to come, but if they cannot come, at least not to miss this opportunity to feel the atmosphere of being in Israel as if they are in the country. And one day they will come, and I'm looking forward for that day.
So you're both facing a similar challenge. You're looking to try to find a way to make Israel accessible to people even when they can't come. And I think, Danny, you're also facing a challenge of trying to keep the Holocaust relevant for generations that are moving away, right? How is that done today, practically? People don't know. They've never met a survivor. They never heard testimony. It's not a simple task.
Well, that's the reason we invest so much in education. Our International School of Holocaust Studies is constantly engaging new audiences, but mainly multipliers, educational multipliers, educators themselves, diplomats, journalists, influencers, law enforcement officials. Those are the areas in which we invest in order to create a multiplication of education. We work all over the world. We had tens of thousands of alumni that we constantly engage in order to convey the message further and further. Much is being said about the fact that for natural reasons, the number of survivors is dwindling rapidly, and someday we will be in a situation in which there will be no survivors. That means that our work will be more difficult, more challenging, no doubt, but much more important, much more vital. So we'll have to redouble our efforts.
Dr. Shai, Minister Shai, one last question. Had the incident, the attack at the Beth Israel congregation gone differently, I can assume that you wouldn't be sitting with us here in Israel right now because you might have been there after the Surfside tragedy. You flew to the U.S. and you were in Miami. Thankfully, that didn't happen. But as we wrap up, a message of just what Israel sends to the Jews of the world in the wake again of that incident and that attack?
We stand with them each time, everywhere, in any given moment. I can sleep all night long. I woke up every few hours, I mean 2 hours, 3 hours, and I looked at my iPhone, figure out what happened. I was so happy to see that one of them was released and then the rest of them. I myself has already been, I already acquired this kind of solidarity, Jewish solidarity that I haven't had in the first half of my life or two thirds of my life. This is something new. Maybe Danny has a different, because he was not born in Israel, but I represent a generation of Israel, of people who were born in Israel. And for them, diaspora was something that they didn't want to talk about. And we actually, I brought my parents to speak Yiddish or Polish or Russian. I said, only Hebrew at home, okay? Big mistake, because I don't speak those languages now. But yes, I mean, now I figure out that diaspora is an integral part of our history. You cannot cut the Jewish history because a new state was born. Just the opposite. This is continuation of our history. That's the message I prepared to, and I will. I talked to the community there, and they're going to have a big gathering. Maybe they will let me address the community very soon. This is part of our life now. And wherever we are, we have to figure out, and we work very hard how to inherit that kind of feeling to the millions of Israelis that were born in Israel. 80% of the Israelis walking in the street now were born in Israel. They don't know what diaspora is. They don't understand what diaspora is. So it doesn't mean that Israel is going to be a diaspora. It's going to survive, as Johnny said, for the eternity. But yes, they should know that there are 8 million people out there, and we are brothers and sisters, literally brothers and sisters. And that's what I'm trying to say to my government and to my colleagues in the government, to the Knesset members and every Israeli I meet. I said, these are your brothers and sisters. Don't forget it.
Okay. Well, Minister of Diaspora Affairs, Dr. Nachman Shai, and Danny Dayan, Chairman of Yad Vashem, thank you very much for being with the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be back next week, as always. If you enjoyed it, please forward this to your friends and family. We're available on all the major podcasting platforms. See you next week.